Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our fates are tied to the fate of our oceans. They generate half of the world's oxygen, as well as provide water, food, recreation, culture, and something like $24 trillion of the global economy. But ocean life is under threat by multiple stressors: climate change, acidification, plastics, pollution, overfishing, overexploitation, and dead zones. In today's Scholar Circle, we spend the hour with four experts about the future of our seas. We discuss the realities facing our oceans and the strides we're making to protect, restore, and recover our seas. Professor Simon Thrush joins us. He's the director of the Marine Science Institute at the University of Auckland. Dr. Rochelle Constantine is senior lecturer and a marine biologist at the University of Auckland. Professor Emeritus Nordin Hassan also joins us. He's the founding director of the Institute for Environment and Development at University Kebangsaan in Malaysia. Dr. Dan Hikaroa also joins us. He is a senior lecturer in Māori Studies, also at the University of Auckland.
Very grateful that you're all here for a really important subject, the future of our seas. We all know intuitively that the healthy oceans really matter for our lives and our livelihoods. But we have these four experts here who can tell us just how much the oceans and our seas matter to our lives and our livelihoods. Simon Thrush, can you start?
I think our oceans are really important. In many ways, you know, we're intimately connected to the oceans. We've all arrived here across the oceans. We utilize marine resources in many, many ways. Part of the way that we do that is directly. We take fish out of the oceans, and it's very common in the media to hear lots and lots of stories and issues associated with how we manage to do that. We pull waste into the oceans. Some of that gets processed by the ocean, so it has less of an effect back on us than would otherwise be the case. But there are many things the oceans do for us that we really take for granted. They're associated with the way that the ecosystem, the connections between the plants, animals, microbes, and the physical environment interact together to change the nature of the way things happen on our planet that are very important that come from our oceans. So dealing with waste that run off from the land, our oceans are hugely important, not just because they dilute it, but because they actually change the nature of some of the most important contaminants we have, like sediments and carbon and nitrogen that's leaching into our rivers. And of course, all our rivers flow downhill. Our oceans, the production in our oceans produces about half the oxygen that's on the planet at the moment. Proportion that's coming out of the oceans is increasing as we lose more and more tropical rainforests. So in other words, every second breath you take is, you can thank the phytoplankton in the ocean for that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a pretty important thing for humans to have is oxygen. And so there are many, many things associated with the oceans that sit like that, that are really out of sight and out of mind. And because the oceans are so vast, or apparently vast, we just take it for granted. But the problem is we really need to change our thinking about that, understand those processes and understand how they are changing in time. So that's why I think the oceans are important.
Rochelle Constantine, what would you add?
I'd just like to add on the notion of scale. I think, you know, as humans we've really struggled in our perception of the ocean because it's that big blue wobbly thing, you know, and we cling to the coast. You know, most of our interactions with the ocean for most people in the world, or for many people, they've never seen the sea, which for New Zealanders is a very unusual concept because we live very close to it and it drives who we are as a people. But in many parts of the world, they've never seen the ocean. But those people that do, we cling to the edges of it. Even when we go out, we're limited by our capacity to go out in our boat or as far out as we can swim or snorkel. And so our understanding of how truly vast the ocean is a real challenge. Because of that, I think that we don't really appreciate those tidal scales, those oceanographic events, the seasonality and the enormous complex dynamics, not only in 2D space, because as humans, we don't fly. So our world is pretty much a 2D world. Every now and then someone will put their head up and look up to the skies and go, oh yeah. But otherwise we're on the land and it's all very two dimensional, I guess. But whereas in the ocean, we're not only talking about, you know, horizontal, but we're talking about these massive vertical fluxes as well. So there's mixing from the depths and there's massive mountain chains and oceanographic events that are going on. And almost all life within the oceans are adhering to those processes, from plankton through to deep sea organisms. And for the things that I study, whales, dolphins, you know, seabirds, sharks, not only are they moving through, you know, up to a few kilometers of that depth of water, but then a great distances from tropics to polar regions. And I think this is one of the big challenges for those of us who work on oceans, is to try and get across to people ways to understand that scale, that massive scale, because everything I just mentioned is critical to our oceans functioning.
Nordin Hassan.
Yeah, thank you. I think I'll push off from where Simon left when he said that we take the oceans for granted, many things. And on the question of scale, I will be approaching this discourse more from the global perspective. And the ocean is globally connected. We can't confine ourselves just to New Zealand. We have to look at how the systems are interconnected globally. This global perspective of oceans relates not only just to the physical and natural processes that goes on, the currents, the ecosystem exchanges, but also in terms of the way we live. Although you're right, we are confined in our immediate view to people interacting with the ocean at the coastal level, but I think a lot of the damage is done by those with capacities to work out in the more pelagic areas. And probably they do more damage, you know, in the sense that what they do have for a long time is unseen. We don't really have a sense of the amount of damage some of these international fishes, for example, do to the oceans. And they change the trophic levels, they remove species, in some instances causing collapse of populations of species. We have this in the North Sea, the cod fisheries. We have this in the off the coast of Chile, the anchovy fisheries. They collapsed, you know, not because of this, the local people. They are done by entities that are global in nature. So the impact of humans on oceans is much, much broader and is sometimes overlooked by common people. But of course, the business and industries, those involved in these activities, they are well aware of what they are doing. For example, I was told that the krill in the Antarctic seas, the southern seas, goes into ice cream in a big way. And there are big firms harvesting krill for the ice cream, basically. Sorry if you like ice cream. But these are implications of our life that we are not normally aware of. And lastly, if I may, I would just like to emphasize the philosophical side of the oceans. We are all of the oceans. Yeah, we are from the oceans. We came out of the oceans. So there is absolutely no excuse for us not to look after the oceans, because this is where life started and this is where the biggest threats from land is coming. So we need not just a worldview that is terrestrial, we need a worldview that includes ocean view. So we need to be aware of the ocean view.
That's the perfect segue for Dan Hikaroa. Thank you.
Absolutely. So Simon says we take it for granted. Rochelle mentions we've got these amazing scales. And then Norda mentions we need an ocean view. And then if I put on a Māori lens on how we view the world, and I think it would be the same for many Indigenous peoples, it's exactly as Norden says, that in the Māori creation, the oceans came first. Land and life came from the oceans. And in a framing of how we understand and conceptualise the oceans, we have the Pacific Ocean, widely known as Te Moana Nui a Kiwa. Kiwa was one of the deities, a part of the whakapapa of life, from which all living and non-living entities and things seen and unseen on this world derive common ancestry from. And the ocean itself is personified as Hine Moana, who is Kiwa's partner. And if we just think about some other examples in New Zealand where we actually have shifted from a view of this being something extrinsic from us and then taking it and having its own legal personhood, we can think of the Whanganui River, we can think of Te Uriwera, where it was that thinking which says, actually, this thing should have its own voice. This thing should have its own rights. And I think that's where we need to start focusing on the oceans. We focus the future of our seas from an entirely anthropocentric view, as in what is the impact upon us and how are we impacting upon the oceans? I think we have the opportunity now, and it actually behoves us, to draw from all knowledges and all learnings to try and save our ocean and maybe give her, from a Māori framing, a voice. And so perhaps the real potential now is to take the learnings, the amazing science information which is being generated by people right up here alongside me, my colleagues, but thinking about how we frame that, not from a command-control approach, but more from how can Hine Moana exert her rights? How can her voice be heard and included in the decisions which we may make on her behalf?
Norden Hassan, you started to lead us down the path of some of the threats that we're facing. So I wonder if maybe now we can turn to how bad are the threats? What are the biggest threats?
I'll take it at three different levels. There are threats that we would consider as global, threats that would be more appropriate to be looked at from a regional perspective, and threats that has to be considered from a national perspective. At the global level, we are all aware of the impacts of climate change. So climate change is a major influence on the future of oceans. Other than that, we know of the effects of climate change on ocean acidification, right? And that is a global matter too, because it affects the seas irrespective of where it is and under which country we are at. At the regional level, there are regions in the world that's developing, expanding very rapidly. And we see, for example, examples of some countries needing to sort of ensure future food supplies for their people, for their rapidly growing populations. So this is not new. It has been happening in the past in different contexts. But we see this happening now where we have countries trying to exert their influence on regions that are highly productive in terms of food. And then it brings us into the question of the security of the region. So that is perhaps one or two examples of the regional concerns with regard to threats to the oceans. Now, at the national level, of course, the impacts are probably more local in nature. Nevertheless, what is missing when you look at things from the national level is the add-on effects. So if we take coastal tourism, for example, on their own, they might be within the limits that the ecosystems can carry. But when you add it all up, it may be crossing the boundaries at the planetary level. So there is that element of the need to focus on also on national level concerns with regard to what you're doing with the oceans.
Simon Thrush, that leads to you because of the add-on effect, that you look at these issues from a big perspective. What are the biggest threats? How bad are they?
So following on from Norden, just to summarize, there have been a number of studies that have been done around the world at various scales in New Zealand, identifying what the major threats are. And the usual culprits that people talk about are fishing. And then we talk about climate change, various aspects of climate change, runoff from land. That's a big problem for us in the Pacific Rim. But the biggest problem of all is really not any one of those things, but it is the fact that they work together and they interact together. And yet the way we think about these things is in a very reductionist way, and we isolate a problem when we think about it. And often we think about a small component of the problem. So when we think about how does the marine ecosystem change as a result of fishing, we're usually only concerned with the stock that is being targeted by that fishery and how that's changing. We don't think about how other species might be responding to that at all. We don't think about disturbance to the seafloor or something like that. And we certainly don't think about what's going to happen with climate change, where potentially the production of the ocean may increase or decrease, or other kinds of factors that will go on within that system will change the ability of that fish stock to maintain itself so that we can keep exploiting it in a sustainable way, hopefully. So that cumulative impact is really the big problem that we face, both in terms of understanding it, but also thinking about managing it. because it is in our legislation that we should do that, but we actually don't do it for all kinds of reasons, because it's really hard.
Simon, before we let you go and let Rochelle go on, what about tipping points? You have been studying tipping points. Where are we in this process with RCs?
So the idea of tipping points is a very common idea that occurs across many different kinds of systems. So it can occur in economic systems and social systems and in ecological systems. And the concept is that you don't have to have a major environmental disaster to call it a major change in that particular system. You can have small changes, often cumulative changes, that can actually have a big effect at any one point in time. And we see this in ocean systems where we have problems associated with eutrophication and overfishing and climate change effects, where the system will change rapidly from one particular state to another particular state. And that change in state often means that some of the ways that we may benefit from the system, whether it happens to be in a cultural way or a food resource way, that they change as well. So the research that we've been involved with doing on tipping points is really trying to understand whether we can get some good indications of where these changes will occur. So that's the ecology side of the question, but also linking that into how we think about managing and governing these systems and how we think about the way that the change actually happens in nature, because the way we tend to do that is in a very linear process. So we essentially believe that, you know, we can control the system like the knob on a stereo system, and we can dial up or dial down the amount of stress that we have on the system, and the system will respond and it will recover. And sometimes that does happen, but often it doesn't, and often the rates of recovery are way slower than we would predict based on what we understand of and how we manage the system right now. So thinking about tipping points makes you think about, we should be thinking about managing our systems, being prepared for surprise, because there's every kind of evidence that surprise will happen. What we think we know may not be enough to allow us to make a good prediction. And so thinking about surprise really radically changes the way we should be thinking about governing and managing our oceans.
Rochelle Constantine?
When you ask sort of what the biggest threats, you know, one of my answer would be indifference. And I think, you know, most of the challenges that are facing the oceans are things that are of our doing. And, you know, I work in conservation science. It's the science of guilt, as someone once told me. You know, we broke it. Gosh, what are we going to do to fix it? And, that, you know, and there's a lot of challenges around that. That whole idea of tipping points is something that's very big in my mind at the moment. We have a couple of upcoming voyages coming up going to Antarctica. And so I'm sort of been knee-deep in humpback whale research lately. And so I work on them in the tropics where they breed in the winter and then they go in the summer months to Antarctica to feed. And so there's been kind of over the last, not quite decade, this interesting thinking about what whaling did, commercial whaling, mainly through the 1900s to Antarctic systems. And so there were over 2 million large baleen whales removed mainly from the Southern Ocean over a relatively short period of time, a few decades really. And by the 1960s, pretty much the entire whale stocks of Antarctica had collapsed. Now, you can imagine these animals are immense. You know, they're around about, you know, 20 up to around about 50 tons in weight. And all they do when they're down there is feed. And so they're consuming massive amounts of primarily krill, Antarctic krill. And so when the whaling stocks completely collapsed, historically, you know, the scientists, ecologists at that time were going, well, gosh, you know, all the whales are gone. I bet there'll be this massive boom in krill, you know, because the main things that are eating them have gone. And then, you know, consequently, there'll be a massive boom in penguins and seals and things that, you know, that were recovering from their own, you know, near extinction events, but nonetheless were doing well. But that didn't really happen. And there was sort of, I guess it sort of sat for a while during the late 1990s, people going, oh, I don't know. And there was sort of conversations about, well, why didn't suddenly everything go boom when all of this potential food was available. And so there's been this conversation around iron seeding and movement of energy through trophic systems. And so the biogeochemistry of the ocean so is influenced by the land and environment around it, but it's also influenced by the carbon movement and nitrogen movement through systems, and biology is a major part of that. So a phytoplankton blooms, it needs a certain ocean chemistry, so it's the beginning of the food chain, it's basically the grass in the sea, so that blooms, and then the krill eat that, and then fish eat that, and whales, etc., etc. So what if the biogeochemistry of the ocean and the Southern Ocean had been altered so much that by the removal of these whales, that there simply wasn't the right conditions for phytoplankton to bloom and in turn the krill to bloom? And so they've gone back and had a look, and there was this iron seeding experiment done. So the Southern Ocean is an iron limited environment, and you need the micronutrients of iron for life to occur. Now, we don't have that issue in New Zealand waters, but in the Southern Ocean it's an issue. And so what they actually did some iron seeding, mostly to stimulate phytoplankton production as a discussion around carbon cycles and dealing with some of the climate change things we've done. But instead they found, they put all this iron in the water and boom, there was heaps of phytoplankton. It was crazy, some really nice, you know, bits of work done. And they're like, wow, that was impressive. And so someone's thought about, well, you know, where's this iron getting locked up? And they found that it's mostly sort of getting locked up at the krill stage. And they found that whales who eat krill, when they poop the krill out the back end, that iron concentration in the whale's poo is 10 million times that of normal background levels. And so this sort of conversation went around, what if whales are iron seeders? What if whale poo, so taking that iron that was sort of locked up in the system, filtering it through and out the back end of a whale, what if that was the thing that stimulated the phytoplankton production in these summer months when there were lots of whales, and in turn more krill and the system was productive? Really, I mean, I've broken this down to really, you know, small kind of reductionist thing. There's a lot of science behind it, but it's a fascinating conversation, and it harks to how the bacterial systems work properly and all of these systems. And so I think from a tipping point perspective, we don't know, because we weren't doing this kind of science in Antarctica when we killed all those whales. But I don't think we have any doubts now that we did something really terrible, where we removed so much mass that it actually really changed how the Antarctic system functioned. And now, by saving whales, you're potentially sort of restoring or changing the Antarctic system back to maybe what it used to be like. We don't know, because, you know, there are other things now going on, like climate change, which is changing extensive sea ice. So these, I mean, they're massive, they're really wicked problems, because we've got things that we did in the past that are slowly recovering because, you know, we're saving the whales, so that's nice. But as a result, we've got that going on, but now we've got some climate change things. And certainly over in places over by the Antarctic Peninsula in that area, where a lot of our humpbacks that go past Raoul go all the way over there almost, that area, there's virtually no sea ice there now. It's dramatically altered. And in contrast, the Ross Sea, which is pretty much due south of New Zealand and our part of Antarctica, that the sea ice is wider, there's more sea ice. So there's some really big things at play. And so a reductionist approach is really not helpful for us in understanding what we can do with the seas. And I would argue that the lessons that we should have learned from the whales, we haven't. And we've now, you know, outfished the big sharks and the big marlins and those big top order fish, and we're fishing our way down the food chain. Now the tunas, you know, the tunas, what we're doing to the tunas is what we did to the whales. And I don't know if we're ever going to learn, because we keep looking at these things in isolation. Whereas that broad approach is just critical, but that requires time, and time is not a friend of political systems, either domestically or internationally. And we watch this, and I think that, you know, we as humans who are going to be here for a really long time, we need to be really mindful that sometimes the long game and the long view, and that's what we require with our understanding of the oceans, that's the thing you've got to keep your eye on, and that can't be hijacked by political systems, either local or internationally.
Dan Higuroa.
And I think what's the biggest threat? It's us. And it's the way that we act and react in our oceans, and it's also the way in which we have that relationship. So tipping points, as an example, in the work that Simon's doing, is trying to understand tipping points such that we might try and predict. We might be getting towards one. How do we avert that happening? However, when they're used in other instances, say for things like the quota management system or for how much we can pollute into the oceans, those tipping points are kind of seen like the speed limit on the highway. Now, I think I'm a pretty law-abiding citizen of this country, and I try and stay right about on that speed limit. From time to time, I just creep over a little bit. And you know, the issue there is that, was our tipping point right? Do we have it bang on anyway? But if we're constantly trying to stay there or thereabouts, the chances of mistakes happening or accidents occurring are much greater. So I think we need to flip that entirely and say we absolutely need to understand those tipping points, but we need to manage it from the perspective of the ocean herself.
Simon Thrush, Nordin Hassan actually used the word collapse. Are we in that potential zone?
I think it's difficult to use the word collapse when you deal with the oceans because they are so vast. Mm-hmm. So there are certain parts of the oceans that have had incredibly serious problems, and we can talk about them having collapsed for sure. And we can talk about certain resources that we might use out of the oceans as having collapsed. So I think we need to qualify the language a little bit. I think it's absolutely clear that the state of our oceans is really not where it should be. We are seeing major changes in the systems, both coastally and offshore, occurring around the world. We're seeing more and more indicators that these changes are going on. And as Nordin said, that the problem is global, and the scale of the problem is often not just associated where we humans are on the land. So the media is full of stories about plastic pollution right now at the moment, and that's a global problem. And every one of us contributes to that, whether it's because we're throwing things, you know, down the drain, or we're just washing polypropylene clothes. We're all contributing to that problem of plastic waste. So collapse is a difficult language. I think we need to be very mindful of the way that we are changing these systems. And as Rochelle and Dan alluded to, a lot of the ways that we change them are because these systems are connected. And the effects we have on these systems are not necessarily the direct and the immediate thing that we immediately spring to. This is the problem. Here's the solution. But they are these indirect consequences that we may or may not understand very well. So learning about how those systems work and how they function is a very powerful tool and knowledge resource that allows us to make better decisions about what we're going to do and how we're going to affect change in these systems.
Well, and the seas are quite different from land, because land is all taken by different countries, but the seas and the oceans are more or less shared. So how do we approach this? Nordin Hassan, you've worked on this a little bit. What do we need to do, and how do we approach this politically and in policy?
I think a long time ago, Gareth Hardin mentioned or came up with the concept of the global commons. I don't know where that went, though, because we're still facing the problems of global commons, really. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Some of the things include, like, the discharge of ballast water from ships traveling the world and introducing all kinds of species into places where they have never been. So really, it is about policing, right? Global commons, especially, because the national boundaries, maybe up to the economic zone, is looked after by national systems. Yeah? But with the global commons, we have to rely then on international or global regulatory or systems. We do have a few, and they seem to be putting a brake on the decline, the health of the oceans. For example, the Governmental Oceanographic, what is it, Committee, IOC. The IOC has rules and regulations governing, for example, ballast water discharge or other pollution by human activities. And this is adopted globally by all the countries concerned, and I think that has brought down the pressure a little in some of the areas of concern in the oceans. As people, the idea of these tipping points is very useful because it helps us think about margins, right? Margins and boundary. How much can we exploit a system? At the global level, there is this new idea of planetary boundaries. I don't know whether you've heard of these planetary boundaries, and they have basically looked at the globe, the planet, and defined 9 parameters that we need to monitor closely, because some, for example, 2, biodiversity loss, or now they call it biointegrity, yeah, of the global system, of the planetary system. And the second one is on the nutrient discharge, yeah, nutrient discharge. Those, they do calculate it, yeah, based on very specific numbers. And for those 2 parameters, it is said that they have gone beyond the boundary of sustainability, planetary sustainability. There are others which are approaching the boundary, and these then we have to give more attention to. And it includes ocean acidification, because ocean acidification, for example, according to the calculations, is not yet at the boundary, but it is fast approaching the boundary. So these sort of ideas and frameworks allow us to think more concretely about what to do and how we develop systems that help us prevent the encroachment towards the boundaries, as it were, or the tipping points, as it were.
Lead us to a tipping point. Mm-hmm. So, Rochelle Constantine, how urgent would you say it is that we start to police these, like Norden is suggesting? What if we didn't?
There's this guy, Panhandle Jack, who used to ride the rails in the United States, and he got arrested. He was doing it illegally, and he went to court, and the judge said to him, "What do you plead?" He says, "I plead anarchy." And he said, "What do you mean? You can't plead anarchy." And he said, "Ah, judge, you know, laws, the good people don't need them and the bad people ignore them." And I think it's a really, it's a very, very appropriate for conservation thinking and frameworks. And you know, I agree. I mean, we do have some, if you look at some of the international agreements and frameworks and you know, sort of global agreements that we will enforce this, I mean, they're really good. Some of them are really good on paper, but the thing is that if these are going to go from beyond being something that we all agree we should do to something that we actually do, and that's the massive difference. You know, it's like, where is that thing in every single human being on this planet where they go, "Oh, the ocean, oh, I have to look after this. We have to do this, and I have to make sure my elected representatives make sure that business or money or whatever is going on to run it does the right thing." And you know, and that's where I think there's this massive challenge, because it's a human thing. You know, people will make this change. So you can have laws, and one of the nice things is with a lot of these you know, new ways of thinking and reframing, there's been a lot of ways of sort of looking at it to try and suit modern socio-political and economic thinking. But nonetheless, the one thing that really does work is that if people engage with an issue, it will affect change. If they want it to change, it will happen. And what we're finding is in some places now, many of the small island states, for example, throughout the South Pacific, are adopting some really high-tech approaches to monitoring their oceans. So big UAVs and drones and things like that. There's increasingly sophisticated devices that are being, you know, to monitor ship movements, ballast discharges. So, you know, there's some really cool technical solutions now that are helping to make people, you know, enforce or make sure they do the right thing, because if they don't, everyone can see them not doing the right thing now because of, you know, modern technology, which I think is really encouraging and may help with that enforcement. There's been some interesting, you know, thoughts knocked around about, you know, do we close the high seas? So roughly about half the oceans are owned by countries within their EEZs, and about half are high seas, roughly. And there's a conversation about, well, what if we just nobody fished in the high seas? would the coastal waters be okay? And there's been some modelling done around on that, which I thought was, you know, some interesting thinking, some new thinking about how we actually look after that global estate. If we didn't do anything in it, then we wouldn't have to monitor it. But you're always going to get cheaters. And we have countries, you know, for example, a few years ago, so they fish for toothfish down in the Southern Ocean, which to me is an interesting, it's a long way to go to catch a fish, and I think reflects quite heavily on what we've done to our fish stocks. But nonetheless, there are a few countries who go down there, including New Zealand, fish these toothfish. There are implications from that. But there are a number of countries that do it illegally, and they'll just go down there because no one pops into the Southern Ocean. You know, it's a really tough place to go, and it's an impossible place to monitor. They'll illegally go down there, catch a whole bunch of toothfish illegally. They won't report it. Now, they don't go back home to their home port. They go to some other port, you know, often in African countries or poorer countries. So once you've got poverty, then corruption will thrive. And so for these illegal nations, and they're often really well-developed, advanced nations that are fishing illegally, they'll land their catch, they'll pay a bunch of money to a poor nation that has to make money somehow, and they'll just not see what's going on. So, you know, we'll always have cheaters, and I think it's human nature that you've got the good ones and the bad ones, and most of us are somewhere in the middle. And I think that provides a real challenge for enforcement. But ultimately, for me, I still go back to that we've got to capture the minds and hearts of people to affect change. And that doesn't matter where or who, but it's critical to affecting change.
We've been talking so much about fish, it makes me wonder if we no longer have plenty of fish in the sea.
We don't. We do, but not the richness and diversity that we used to have. And systems are definitely struggling, and that's polite.
Dan Hikaroa, what do we need to be doing as people, as policymakers? What do we need to do now?
Well, my suggestion comes back to one of the enabling rules that allows all these things to happen that we're talking about, illegally or legally, is the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. It's based on a concept of mare nullius. Many people are familiar with terra nullius, which was kind of the land without owner. The marine equivalent is mare nullius. And so therefore, because it was the open ocean or land without owner, it became the common heritage of mankind. Because no one owned it, then people could do what on earth they liked, unless we had these other rules in place. And then it's about who polices them under whose jurisdiction. Terra nullius has proven to be non-legally based. It's been tossed out in Australia and then around the world now. I believe the Pope actually apologised to the world because the concept of terra nullius and mare nullius came from papal bulls in the 15th century. And it was just last year where he apologised to the nation, or to the world, and said we need to find better ways in which we could behave. So the idea that I've been putting forward is we don't think mare nullius is any legal foundation. And if we can demonstrate that the people in the Pacific Ocean, which is the one I'm familiar with, had a vast knowledge of it, they didn't see it as a something that separated them. They saw it as a great connector. And they saw that was their common ancestry was through the oceans. And so if we took this idea of Hine Moana being her own identity, being her own legal personhood, then she would have a voice, and all those people who were doing things illegally or legally would have to ensure, for the legal ones, there would be people who are motivated, and for the illegal ones, there would be others who are motivated to ensure those things didn't happen. I think these ideas have been picked up around the world. I know in Bolivia and Ecuador, and I think in the Ganges, they picked up on, and the River Ganga now has its own legal personhood. This idea is picking up impetus around the world, and I think if we want to pick up on what Rochelle has said, people need to get behind us. The current system is not working for us. We know that. What we're looking for is something new, and maybe we can draw from Indigenous thinking to bring that. And of course, and to Norden's comment around these planetary boundaries, we are all Indigenous to this planet. We need to start behaving like that.
I thought it would be a good time to open it up to those of you who might have questions for our panelists. If there's some people who'd like to ask questions, please.
So you guys have talked a lot about the preservation of our oceans based on more than just singular species, because species interact within their environments and potentially with other ocean ecosystems. And so But a lot of the conservation measures, even though we're kind of moving towards the prospect of ecosystem-based conservation, it seems like a lot of governing bodies are still focusing on these singular biological species. And so I know that the New Zealand Priority Species List just came out, which lists singular species and prioritising their conservation. But ideally, we want to be looking at an ecosystem-based approach. And I was just wondering if maybe people find it too hard to try and preserve a whole ecosystem, and what measures do we put in place to do that? And I was just wondering how you think that we could change things to better move towards ecosystem-based conservation.
In terms of conservation of species, I mean, that's the most practical way of having a legal framework for conservation, because the unit of that you're conserving is very specific and clear and definable. With ecosystems, which looks at communities of species and the interactions that they work with, I think in the 90s, Canada tried to put forward legislation that looked at ecosystems' health. But it didn't work because it's so complex. Why it didn't work was you couldn't quantify the contribution of each individual member of that community and put that down in a legal framework. So that was a problem then. But you must be aware of the IUCN, the World Conservation Union, and the Species Red List. That is very helpful, right, in terms of countries wanting to legislate on particular species. If they are on the red list, you can have a good justification to put it in as a protected species, for example. But the IUCN is now working on a red list of ecosystems, which is a major step forward, I think. When it was mooted, I wondered whether how it would work, you know. But it does look like they have begun to have a framework to define threatened, endangered ecosystems throughout the world. So when their scientists then come up with a framework for this red list of ecosystems, then perhaps countries, because the laws that work need to work at the national level. The global laws, as you mentioned, you know, they provide a framework. They are soft laws. If, for example, the country doesn't adopt and translate it into national legislation, there's very little that the countries can do on their own. So that is, I think, the development that's happening towards ecosystems management more firm. Yeah.
Just to add a little bit to what Norden was saying, species conservation is important because, you know, they're the cute and furry things that people are concerned about, and, you know, the whales and dolphins and all the stuff. And it's nice having a planet to share with those animals, so that's good. But we do need to move into a much more systems-focused space, as you're alluding to, and there are lots of agendas that facilitate that. Some of it is actually easier than worrying about species, because if you understand a little bit about elements of what the habitats are within the system, then you can think about conserving those. And so actually, in some ways, it would simplify management if only our managers could think in that way, but they can't for many reasons. So thinking about the system, and here we're talking about both the natural ecosystem but also the social system that we interface with, that then becomes very important. But the other thing that's happening, I think, with conservation is, you know, for a long time we've had this kind of war going on between conservation and resource exploitation. And so the conservationists have been trying to conserve things, and other groups within society, you know, that are investing in using resources are trying to exploit them. And there's been this battle, and it's been almost a territorial carve-up that generically the conservationists have lost. Today, I think we're much more in a space of thinking in a much more integrated way about how we conserve things and how we do that within the concept of also utilising those resources. So, again, as Dan was talking about, you know, the large ocean states of the Pacific, that they often have this theory of, you know, conserve some and use some. And if you think about conservation going hand in hand with exploitation, then you really truly can manage what's going on, because strategies where you say we're going to have marine protected areas, that's an ecosystem scale management, if you like. You know, what we end up with is these conservation jewels in a sea of what, and how do they work together? So we really need to think about pulling out of that kind of sectarian management of conservation versus exploitation. That's really important too.
You know, we didn't talk that much about other forms of exploitation like mining and offshore drilling and that type of a thing. We talked about overfishing and how we've overfished so much of the seas. Should we be concerned about the mining and the offshore drilling? Is that a big factor that we should also be thinking about? Rochelle, what do you think?
It is in some places. You know, it's a highly dynamic industry, the mining and exploitation and even, you know, just exploration. And it impacts the oceans in really different ways. And it impacts different species in different ways. And, you know, in New Zealand, of course, we've, you know, got oil and gas and, you know, some exploration that went on, and it sort of hit its peak a couple of years ago. And then, you know, the global market changed and they sort of pretty much all disappeared. And, you know, I got a lot of interesting calls because everyone's worried about whales and dolphins, particular washing up on the beach in droves because of seismic testing. And it's just not going to happen. And it doesn't mean it has a zero impact, though, but it does have a particular, you know, noise associated with it and things like that. And I've often had conversations with people that if you go out into some of our really busy waterways, you will get a much greater, more chronic level of noise pollution in those marine environments than you will for, say, a seismic survey done off, you know, the bottom of the South Island. And, you know, and people are sort of a little bit surprised by that, but you know, you go out in the Hauraki Gulf and you chuck a hydrophone over, which we do. We've got some work with Craig Radford in marine science, listening to the soundscape of the Hauraki Gulf, and a major contributor to the noise pollution is boats. Now, that's all those people. You know, there's shipping, of course, but then there's, oh, I'm just going out for a quick fish, or I'm going for, you know, I'm sailing, there's not much wind, I'm motoring. You know, all of those things actually contribute to the noise as well. So there are many, many impacts. And I fully agree with Simon, you know, that one of the greatest disappointments to me, because I'm kind of a joiner, I'm not a splitter, you know, so it really frustrates me when you have an issue and then a whole bunch of people went to that corner and a whole bunch went to that corner and you're like, oh gosh, because we're never going to be able to have the conversation we need to have. And we're not very good at difficult conversations. And so if there's things like exploitation of some kind or a potential threat, and there are many things that could come under, I know at least in New Zealand, we seem incapable of actually just getting down and having the difficult conversation and being comfortable with disagreement. And we had this recently in the Hauraki Gulf, we have a resident population of brooders whales, and the main threat to them was death by ship strike, right? So this sort of came onto our radar in around 2007 or so. 2012, we released some findings, and, you know, science got together with the shipping industry and Tangata Whenua and NGOs and me as the scientist and said, look, this is the issue. These are the potential solutions. Industry said it'll cost us too much to slow down. They decided eventually, after a bit more science and a bit more disagreement at the table, that they would have a voluntary protocol to slow down. Now, for the last two and a half years, they have voluntarily gone at around 10 or 11 knots, which is what we asked them to do. Now, they just did the right thing. Boy, we had some doozy arguments in that room, in the collaborative working group room, and we all came from very different angles, but we hashed it out. The kaupapa of the group was that it was okay to disagree and we had to keep moving forward. And we don't have dead whales washing up in the Hauraki Gulf now from ship strike. But that was a really quick and simple but remarkable example of how conservation can work. If we'd gone to our corners, there would still be dead whales washing up. So I think, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's mining or tourism or fishing or whatever new thing may come along, we have to get over ourselves, genuinely listen to other viewpoints and come to a solution, which is not going to be what anyone exactly wants. I think it's really critical. And that probably holds for the global stage as well.
Sure, yeah. You know. If I may say about the global stage, you know, I mean, there is now a new international program for research. It's a platform for research on global sustainability called Future Earth. If you Google the term, you'll come across a web page that describes this new approach to working scientific research and implementation, which aims to be integrative. So bringing the different people together and talking about issues rather than subjects, subject matter. And the research that they're promoting is supposed to be collaborative, integrative, transdisciplinary, and for evidence-based decision-making. So the program is about 3 years old now. It's still new, still in process of establishing the various frameworks to enable this multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary type work. And for oceans, they have what is known as Oceans CAN, K-A-N, Knowledge Action Networks. And within this, you have a whole range of stakeholders, not just the disciplinary scientists working in their own little corner, as you were mentioning. So globally, then there is this move or this desire to move into a more integrative and holistic approach to the generation of knowledge and the management of the oceans.
I think what worked, sorry if I could really quickly, what worked there was not a legal-based framework. It was a values-based framework. So there's a difference. You can try and hit them with the laws, but it was at the end of the day, it was their values shifted, and that was the argument that won the day. And, I mean, I've been touting the work that Rochelle did there because, effectively, she gave voice to the Brutus whales. It was the voice of the Gulf, and so that was heard and listened to. And to answer your question, and I was waiting for either of these two to answer it, ecosystem-based management is one of the key research strands and one of the significant government research projects in sustainable seas. So you could be part of the solution. Sorry, just had to say that.
No, that's great. And I just wonder, Dan Hikaroa, if you need both, you know, the value system and
absolutely.
The legal.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Just going off that, in light of Thomas Matton, who was the co-author of the Yellow-Eyed Penguins report that's just come out, he was saying, you know, there's so much thinking being done, but not enough action. And today we've been talking about ideas, we've been talking about research, we've been talking about conversations being had. But when have we got enough research? When do we know enough to say, okay, let's really do something now, and what can that be, and when can we do that?
I can start by answering that and you guys can follow in. But I would say that right now we have a lot more knowledge than we're actually using in terms of making decisions. So we could do more today. We could have done it last decade as well, but we could do more today than we currently do. It's really a question of lack of knowledge except around the detail of something. Getting engagement and affecting changes is really problematic. And it's problematic for all the reasons we've been talking about of requiring people to engage, having systems in which people can feel that they can affect change. I mean, one of the big problems with the climate change issue is it's global. It's the climate. And you think of what we do, and we can be concerned about our contribution on a national basis, on a per capita basis, and we should be. But we've got countries in the Northern Hemisphere that are pouring out way more than we can deal with. So how do you fix that problem? Well, it turns out, particularly around this issue with ocean acidification, is we can fix that problem because the problem really isn't about climate. It's about land use, and it's about the interaction between the coast and the oceans. And we can fix that stuff. And that's why, for a lot of these problems, it is a recognition of some things will be easier to fix than others, some things we can mitigate more readily than others, and we can move into actions. But as Rochelle alluded to, a lot of these problems are these complicated, wicked problems. They're not, I have the answer, this is solution, if you do this, problem solved. So we constantly need to be rethinking and looking at it from a different perspective, learning from what we're doing and adapting what we're doing. So there's never the case of, you know, I have the answer for you. If only you do this, that problem will go away. We live with these problems. We don't kind of solve them in the way that we would like, the politicians would like it, and you know, we would all like to be able to say, yep, don't have that anymore.
I'd also add to that, sorry, there is actually a heap of work going on. So the recent work on the Sea Change Taitimu Taipari Marine Spatial Planning for the Hauraki Gulf Marine Park identified the two major things facing the health of the Hauraki Gulf are sediment and nutrients. One of the legislative statutory frameworks which hampered anything happening was because you have the Fisheries Act, and then you have what happens on land, and then you have DOC, and then you have the council. So there was the frameworks we work in. However, despite that, there are groups like the Integrated Kaipara Harbour Management Group, which are affecting magnificent change. And actually, what we need to focus on is those people in those catchments will make the most difference to the quality of the oceans around our coasts and the next generations. If every single catchment in this country was doing stuff, we would be well on the way to achieving great outcomes just for our stretch. So it is happening, and we're talking about, because we're constantly learning, so it's concurrent.
Well, we are out of time, so let me thank all of you for coming, but also I want to thank the panelists. Their contribution is amazing, both for science and for us here. Simon Thrush, Rochelle Constantine, Nordin Hassan, Dan Hikaroa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Professor Simon Thrush is the director of the Marine Science Institute at the University of Auckland. Dr. Rochelle Constantine is senior lecturer and a marine biologist at the University of Auckland. Professor Emeritus Nordin Hassan is the founding director of the Institute for Environment and Development at University Kebangsaan in Malaysia. Dr. Dan Hikaroa is a senior lecturer in Māori Studies, also at the University of Auckland.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at @ourmoodian, and we'll see you next week.